Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, Diane. How are you doing?
Well, we beat the storm out of Philly last Sunday and
so
made it home
did.
Without incident. Yep, we did good. What about you?
We had a new temp in the office where I work this week.
Oh?
Her name was Sandy. She came in, trashed a lot of stuff, made the toilets all overflow. We thought she was going to quit, you know, like a couple of days into the week, and she just stayed around.
Yeah.
Kept going. And now next week we hear that we might be getting another temp in the office, Mary Sunshine.
Mary Sunshine would be very welcome. Actually, we did see some sunshine this week.
A little bit.
It was funny. The minute the sun came out, I mean, there were a million posts on Facebook. The sun's out, the sun's out.
Yeah.
Yes, it was lovely. It was like 6 or 7 days without, I mean, it was just horrific. It just did nothing but rain.
Well, and, you know, we like to complain about our gray skies and rain and loss of electrical power. But really, once again, here in Northeast Ohio, we have managed to dodge the worst of it.
We did.
And
I know.
We shouldn't make light of it because New York and New Jersey really
they took the brunt of it.
Horrific destruction and devastation. Yeah. And so, you know, all of our listeners and family and friends and whoever on the East Coast, we hope that the rebuilding happens and happens quickly. And we're sorry for the loss of life and injury that accompanied this 1,000-mile-wide storm.
Well, you know, as I said, we were in Philadelphia, and I have to give a big shout out to Bina Belinky and her crew. They did a great job in light of the fact that we all knew this was coming. I did rush back to Cleveland because I had a chance to interview one of the great triathletes of all time, the king of triathlon, Dave Scott, who was a 6-time Ironman winner, was in town at the Cleveland Clinic's annual Medical Innovation Summit. He was sitting in on a panel to talk about his experiences with the orthopedic community. This is an amazing summit. They had something like 950 attendees from all over the world, and it's all about medical innovation, and it's all gamut. Yeah, it runs the whole gamut from, you know, neurology to physiology to orthopedics to cardiology, everything. It was just amazing. So I got a chance after he was done with the panel to sit down in a quiet little room, and we spent a half hour just chatting. So we do have his interview tonight. We talked about his career, his views on the sport, what he's doing now. He's just amazing. So he's on in a few minutes. Then at the second half of our show, I mentioned last week that there were 17 fellowships awarded by the German Marshall Fund of the U.S., Cleveland State University, Virginia Polytechnic, and Virginia Tech, to launch a program called Strong City, Strong Communities. And one of those fellows, Chris Alvarado, lives and works right here in Cleveland. I met Chris at the Bike Summit last March. He is one go-getting kind of guy. So I invited him to come to the studio to talk to us about his fellowship, what's happening with cycling and transportation and sustainable cities. And he'll be with us a little later in the show. And then we have some news. So want to get to it?
Let's go.
All right. Here's my interview that I recorded earlier this week with 6-time Ironman winner Dave Scott. Hello, Dave Scott. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. What an honor to be able to sit and talk with you face to face.
Thank you, Diane. Here we are in this little tiny room, and we're all by ourselves here at the Medical Innovations Clinic. This is awesome.
The Cleveland Clinic Foundation is huge. They are huge, and they do a lot of medical innovation stuff, and we are going to talk to it about it. So you do like the summit? Are you having fun?
Yeah, great time. The clinic itself has been fabulous, and it's really first class, and quite a diverse group of people that are here. It's not just physicians, and of course there's a panel that I was on,
right.
And I was, you know, enjoyed just sitting there listening to Zydrunas, who played here in Cleveland, and it's been quite fun.
Good. Well, that's good. So we're talking about the summit. What was your role in that panel? What was that panel about?
The panel was sort of a connector panel between the athletes and what the physicians are now doing, predominantly for orthopedic rehab. And the other two athletes that were on the panel, have had some serious injuries. I had one in 2009, well after my heyday in the sport.
Oh, I thought that this went back to a car or an accident that you had, a car crash. So what happened in 2009?
2009 was the car accident.
Oh, it was.
It
okay.
was, yes.
Okay.
I had a couple other surgeries, a medial meniscus surgery on my knee back in 01. But the 09 accident, I was actually coming back close to home, about three-quarters of a mile, and I actually had contemplated doing Ironman again. And I had a six-week block, had finished a ride. It happens to be 56 miles and rode it fairly quickly and said, you know, I'm going to go to Hawaii in October 2009. Anyway, I hit the car and it threw me to the ground. I fractured my hand very badly, multiple fractures. They had to put, there's 18 different portals where they put screws in, and my wrist was broken and shattered my scapula and also had a blood clot in my lung. So it was a pretty serious accident. And to this day, 3.5 years later, I'm still rehabbing my shoulders. You can see my finger is quite crooked.
I see it.
But life goes on. The shoulder actually, it was shattered like a plate glass window, and it drooped down, so it was externally rotated. And of course, all the musculature just shut down. I had tremendous swelling and huge pain. But there was no reconstructive surgery on it. They just said it's got to mend by itself. But to this day, I have a lot of scar tissue around there and immobility in my serratus and lats. So it's not functionally back by any means.
Doing any yoga?
I do yoga, and I am still mad about exercise. So I have a very diligent program where I'm trying to retract my scapula and work my lower traps and mid traps and serratus muscle and stretch my pec. So I adhere to a pretty strict regimen.
So when you were racing in the 80s, at least the Wikipedia part that I read said you followed a pretty strict diet.
Well, I think, Diane, back then people sort of alluded to my diet that Dave Scott was really smart and he had this physiology background, and that sort of stemmed off into nutrition, so he knew what he was doing. I don't think I was very smart at all, and still don't. I think we're a lot wiser because the information in the sport is more available, and trial and error is part of it, but the science-based background on endurance performance is huge. So back in the 80s, as you probably recall, it was all about carbohydrates.
Right.
And we were told you should have carbohydrates, and we really didn't define what carbohydrates were. There were simple carbohydrates and there was complex, as we've known for a long time. But I needed calories, so I was eating, and in hindsight, not a terribly healthy diet. I was eating a very, very high, refined carbohydrate diet, which is very, very unhealthy, heart unhealthy. Functionally unhealthy, my protein levels were too low, and certainly my healthy fats, the omega-3s, were extremely low. So when I look back on it, people said, gee, you know, you're eliminating saturated fat, you are taking out some of the processed foods, Dave Scott has a healthy diet. And I look at it and think, you know, really, it was kind of catastrophic. And I was actually able to survive and on paper do quite well. It was predominantly a vegetarian diet. In fact, I followed a vegetarian diet, a lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet, so I didn't have any beef that was hormone-fed, and I haven't had any red meat for 35 years. But I switched my diet around in about 1993. 1994, I came back to do the Hawaii Ironman after a five-year hiatus. I was 40 then, and I was much healthier from that point on from a diet standpoint to the present because I started eating a lot more fish. And that's become sort of a central part of and foundation of my diet. I eat a lot more leafy greens, and I have a tremendous amount of healthy fats, which I didn't have back in the 80s.
Yeah, people have this aversion to fat, not understanding that the body does need some fats, healthy fats, of course, like avocados are good.
Yeah, absolutely, and I eat a lot of avocados, and that's a good example. A lot of the fats, the healthy fats, have a thermic effect. In other words, it helps rev up your body metabolism. So it's sort of an oxymoron. People say you eat fat, you're going to gain fat. Well, that's not true. So,
right.
And you know, one of the areas that I address, just to divert a little bit, in working with athletes, and predominantly female athletes, they want to lose weight, and they want to get down that lean body weight, and so they end up starving themselves during their exercise session. They may have 150 calories on a four-hour bike ride, and then they don't eat afterwards. And they say, well, I'm continuing to starve myself. Well, the body is very smart. It recognizes that, and it puts yourself in a starvation mode. So you end up catabolizing muscle tissue,
right,
which is what they don't want, and really conserving fat, because it's conserving fat around the organs. So it's coming back to your diet question, it's something that I'm really keen on as far as advising people. I think I'm a lot smarter than what I was back in the 80s.
Sounds like
I was
it.
Racing.
It sounds smart by today's standards.
Well, I think if I had known what I had known now, and I was very receptive to training strategies, to nutrition, not just healthy nutrition, but a fueling for the exercise, and the two gigantic areas that I talk to athletes all the time now, I probably get 50% of the questions, email questions, about nutrition and performance, and nutrition just from a healthy standpoint. Those are massive topics. If I had known what I had known now in the last 30-odd years, I certainly would have applied it to myself.
Sure.
And people ask me, they said, well, you're on an athletic diet because you're still athletic. And I said, it's no different than a healthy diet. And I would advise you as a semi-sedentary person to follow a like diet, because it's a healthy diet. Just reduce your portion size and so on. There's a few more factors involved. But athletes need to pay attention to that, and really in all sports, across the board from a strength sport to an endurance sport. And nutrition is certainly X percentage of performance.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Dave Scott, the god of triathlon. Sorry, I have to say that. From my day, which goes back a few years. So let me ask you something about what's going on right now in our industry, and that's power. People are talking about power and getting power output information and how important power is. How important is power?
Power we can look at in all three sports, but power, as I'm sure you're referring to, is power on the bike. We're looking at power output on the bike, and we're looking at the watt meters. And so when you're out riding, we're looking at average power or peak power. But I really look at it for an endurance athlete. I'm looking at also at energy systems. So if we look at triathletes, and I'll make this very brief, you should really establish about a 12 to 15 minute power output, because a big percentage of 12 to 15 minutes is kind of looking at your max VO2, and it has a high anaerobic component without oxygen. And so you really want to see, okay, what can my machine drive for 12 to 15 minutes? What can I do? And I look at this also on the run and the swim. When I coach Chrissy Wellington and Craig Alexander, advised with them, we do a VO2 type workout as they lead up to the Hawaii Ironman, because I think a lot of people neglect and consequently end up going slower because they think, I'm going to go long, slow distance, and I'm going to go faster. Well, it doesn't work that way. You have to increase the functional power of your output. Look at that 12 to 15 minute block as a sort of a prerequisite to set the foundation for, which will really enhance your aerobic engine. I also look at 30 minutes, and I also look at, you know, it's sort of a nebulous term, lactate threshold. In simple terms, if people have been exercising for about 2 to 4 years, on the swim, if you look at about a 20 to 40 minute output, what can you do for 20 to 40 minutes? We can establish a lactate threshold. In running, anywhere between about 35 minutes up to an hour. We kind of fall in that range. The more skilled athletes, a little bit longer than that. And on the bike, because you have variable gearing, we can look at power output and variable terrain, anywhere between 45 minutes to about an hour 15. Get a number, a power output number, for those ranges. And that is a good baseline. We quite often govern our workouts on, oh, I did a long ride, and it took me 5 hours, and I averaged 18 miles an hour.
Right, I hear that all the time.
Yeah, and you're in the industry, so I think what people forget about doing, and let's just talk about Ironman training or half Ironman training, is that once their body has made that initial adaptation and their aerobic plumbing is really enhanced, their blood volume's gone up, their capillary density gone up, their mitochondria, their aerobic enzymes, all the thing that tells them they're aerobically fit, and most people need anywhere between about 8 to 20 weeks to develop that platform. You have to do higher intensity training so that you innervate, and this is the power question that you had. There are really two types of muscle fibers, and there's different segments of those two. There's a slow twitch that's right, firing all the time and even under fast loads. And there's one that's sort of an intermediate one. It's quite often called the intermediate one. It's called the fast twitch 2A muscle fiber. And it can shift to help those slow twitch. In other words, when you're going up a hill or when your arch competitor goes by you and you have to call on a little faster turnover, a little higher power output, those fast twitch 2A muscle fibers are the ones that are innervated. And so I'm really keen on, let's go back to this long ride, that they integrate, an athlete integrates higher intensity workloads in a long ride because it wakes up those 2A muscle fibers, and it also teaches your body to conserve muscle glycogen. So when they get in a race, quite often you'll see an athlete go a half a mile or a mile an hour faster in different sections, and if they've never trained that in their workouts, even a higher workload than that, all of a sudden they burn through their fuel, their muscles are fatigued, they haven't innervated those fast twitch 2A muscle fibers, and consequently when they get to the run, they're dead.
They can't call on anything.
Yep. Anything. And less is sometimes better. And bring up your intensity.
Right.
And that's a real good factor in determining performance because, again, if you have an X amount of time, doing a half Ironman or an Ironman distance doesn't give you the license to go slow. So keep your intensity up. The world champions train hard and they train fast and they keep that sprint and Olympic distance speed. Craig Alexander tries to retain that high end, and that's why he goes fast in the Ironman race. Chrissy Wellington is an endurance machine, and I have to really have her work on that fast end so that she can ride her bike at 24 miles an hour in the Ironman race.
Is that the right number, 24?
Well, that's what she does.
Okay.
That's what she does, and most of the women can't do that because
no,
she's darn
that's
fast.
That's a big number.
But the big thing for her is that she was always turning over with really slow RPM. She was in the high 70s. We got her up to the mid-80s, low to mid-80s. She's not going to go any higher than that.
Okay.
And we'll see a lot of people spin at 90 and so on. They'll say, well, that's the best range. But force on the pedal, the more force you put on the pedal, when she's going 75 RPMs, she's fatiguing those fast twitch 2A muscle fibers. Speed of movement also innervates those fast twitch. So you have to have kind of a balance. So she was wearing out those fast twitch 2A, and almost every Ironman race on the run, she was going out at 121 or 122 at the halfway point of the run, very fast, and she was dying. She was going 127 or 128. Well, everyone's going to look at that and say, well, that's still 248 or 249. She finally did it in Roth where she even split her runs. I think, I'm not a genius on this at all, but I think one of the areas that she was weak is that she wasn't turning over fast enough. We weren't integrating speed of movement on her run and also on her bike so that she was able to bring back the second half of her run. I know that's kind of a convoluted answer.
Not really.
It's important do faster stuff in your long sessions.
What do you think are the biggest changes in triathlon from when you first began to do it to today's, not just athlete, but equipment and the racing itself?
Well, I'm not very good on triathlon innovations. I mean, look at the industry. Someone had just sent me some pictures of the 1986 Ironman, which I was able to win, and they showed me on my Centurion Ironman bike.
Oh, I used to sell those bikes.
Uh-huh. They sold quite well.
I hope they made
some money.
I hope so.
And, you know, I have got these floppy clothes on, this real heavy, heavy one-pound helmet sitting upright, no aero bars. And so I look at the technology now, and the men and women, all levels, pros and age groups, are riding these rockets. The aerodynamically, the metals that are used in it, the componentry, everything is fast. We didn't have fast bikes, but we rode them fairly well back then. That's amazing to see. Shoe technology, yeah, I can't really speak about all that stuff. I look at it. I want people to advise me. I look at the racing, though, and with the advent of the ITU and the Olympic distance racing, draft legal races, and we look at the best women and men that are racing the ITU World Cup races and the Olympics, they are fast. They are real fast. And everyone kind of poo-poos them if you're doing a half Ironman or Ironman. I look at them with great admiration. I look at the Brownlee brothers, and they are explosively fast on the swim. Very, very fast. They have a menacing, threatening pace on the bike, and they challenge anyone on the bike right at the outset. We're talking 40K, and they just slam it, and they're extremely good climbers. And on the run, it's their best link. I mean, they're kidding. I just explained the first two. They're brilliant, and their run, I think because they wear people out, certainly by the punishing pace on the swim, but they carry that on the bike leg. And we're seeing very, very fast runs. The run times with the elite men, where they're going under 31 minutes, quite often under 30, and occasionally 29 minutes off the bike, is extremely fast. And we're seeing the women run 34 or better off the bike. These are fast times. It's interesting because when we've seen history since I've raced, and a lot of the Olympic distance guys that are stepping up to the half and the Ironman distance race, extraordinarily fast half Ironman times on the bike and also the run. I mean, they're riding at 28 miles an hour on the bike, and we're seeing the Raylert brothers and a handful of others that have run under 110 off the bike. This is extremely fast pace, 510 pace per mile, 508 pace per mile. But we're not seeing that same speed translate to the Ironman distance. The extraordinary runners, men and women, pros, that have gravitated up and are mastering the half Ironman races still are not running at the pace that I think they should be in the Ironman. And I've said this every year, and people always ask me as if I have the crystal ball. I look at the men's field, look at the women's field. The men should be running 235 to 237 at 6 minute pace off the bike in Kona, and they can't do it.
What are they running?
They haven't done it. Mark Allen and I, who had seemingly this great battle in 1989, there wasn't chip timing in the what's recorded in the history of the annals of the sport is that Mark ran 240, I ran 241.02, but our actual run time that year, and I had a close friend who was looking at our splits and took out the transition, which was included
right.
in our run time. Mark actually ran 238.58, and I was 239.56. And I look at those times and say, well, okay, that was fairly fast, but the men nowadays are a lot better runners than I ever was. I mean, I looked terrible when I ran. I looked like a wounded buffalo, and I was all over the place, and my feet were splayed out to the side, and my chest was up. I was just horrific. But I was strong, and I'm just waiting for the men to break through. I think my point is that we're going to see the men and women that are doing the Olympic distance races very well, and they're going to keep moving up to the half and the Ironman, and we will continue to see breakthrough in times.
Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dave Scott. We're here at the Cleveland Clinic Medical Innovation Summit. So he came to our city today, and it's really, really an honor to be able to speak with him. So the last thing I want to talk about is not a pretty topic, but and I don't know what you know about it, what you think about it, but I ask almost anybody who races in our sport, whether it's triathlon or bike racing, I want to talk about doping. You don't hear much about it in the sport of triathlon, where at least certainly I don't, and we hear about it only all the time in cycling. If it's going on, why aren't we more aware of it? And if it's not going on, how come triathlon has been able to sort of keep it under control, which evidently I think it has? Yes or no?
I think the testing for triathlon has become a lot more thorough. For example, I coach a group in Boulder, swimming and also running, and I have a lot of the elites and a lot of the pros, and they have to register with the Anti-Doping Association. They have to give them their daily curriculum. Where are you going to be? They come out there all the time on the pool deck unannounced, and they'll ask for X athlete. Are they here? And I'll say, yes, they're right here. They pull them out of the water. They do the blood test and so on. It seemingly is very, very random. I was tested way back in the 80s, and there were a few aberrations. There was a few people that tested positive, and I didn't even know, you know, I knew about different drugs just from the physiological standpoint.
Sure.
Like steroids would enhance muscle growth and possibly recovery, but I didn't know if they were prevalent in our sport, and I would never have suspected any of the athletes that I'd raced against ever using them. I just thought, no, our sport is untainted. They're all pure. I think it's kind of a naive overview and a very myopic overview of saying they're not doing it. The notoriety in the sport right now to be the world champion, to be the best, is huge. And the athletes that are at the top are reaping the benefit, but we don't have a good infrastructure in really paying the other athletes that are coming up to allow them to prosper, to press it. Are those athletes taking drugs? I honestly don't know. I think that we look at endurance sports, it seems like it's permeated, obviously, cycling, and we're all aware of the news today. It's been in Nordic skiing. There's been issues with that.
Hmm.
And I think in triathlon, You know, I'd have to say it's there. I do know of an age grouper, 55, 59. It's been all over the internet. That was pulled randomly and tested positive.
Who would think at that age that you'd even bother? It's like, so what? You're not going to be the world champion at 59.
Well, the irony is that people are putting on world champion at 55, 59. They're not winning the entire event, but for their age group. And so everyone has these glorious titles. And I think there's a lot of people that we'll want to take that extra edge, and we see it. And it just makes me sick when I think about it. And I never would have suspected, and I'd almost say if I had all the athletes that I competed against in the 80s and early 90s and were sitting at a table, I would say, well, none of you took drugs. We just didn't do it. We were tested, and ironically, between 1989, when I was second to Mark Allen, and I didn't race for 5 years, there was more drug testing in 1994 when I sort of had a high-profile position that I was going to come back and do Hawaii. And there was a lot of media and a lot of hype, and I did some early-season races. I was actually tested 3 times that year and also tested in Hawaii. And I thought, gosh, is this really random? I don't think it was random.
That doesn't sound random to me.
No, well, I don't think it was random at all. And at the same time, it wasn't really an inconvenience. So I said, okay, I think as a sport – whatever the decision is to test me, I'm kind of glad that they did it. So here are the results. Here you can see it. Right. You know, it's the last thing that would enter my mind because I obviously did my homework for the race and felt as though I was, you know, getting fitter by the month coming into it. But the drugs that permeate the sport, I mean, it really is an evil part of performance. And you know, we've got to look at the sport and say we want everyone on the same table. We want on the same level playing field. Let's do everything we can as far as post-exercise therapy. Let's look at them nutritionally. Let's do strength and injury prevention training. Let's build these athletic machines legally.
I like that.
Anyway, I can digress on lots of different topics.
Yes, Diane. You can, and do it very well. You know what? I wish we weren't out of time, but you probably have to show up for dinner tonight, and I am going to go home and make dinner tonight. I hope you travel safe. I don't know when you're supposed to leave, but they may not let you leave.
Well, they haven't. They've canceled my ticket for tomorrow morning,
yeah, so
I might be here at the Medical Innovations Conference longer than what I intended.
You know, I really appreciate being able to actually sit and talk to you face-to-face. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure, Diane.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Dave Scott and Diane Lees sat down at the Cleveland Clinic this past week for a very informative and interesting conversation.
He's a really cool guy. I could have talked to him all day. He's so intelligent. Well, you could tell that from the interview. He's pretty cool.
Nice.
Nice was right.
Well, let's take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we're going to catch up on the news.
Yes, we
and
can.
And then welcome a gentleman here into our studio by the name of Chris Alvarado.
Yes.
So stay tuned for all that and more right here on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
So I'm a dog, and I just got adopted by this new human guy, and I'm starting to wonder how he got along without me. I mean, okay, something as simple as walking around the block. He's got this leash thing, and he puts me on one end and him on the other, and I'm just taking him around. I think he's afraid of getting lost. Without that leash and me guiding him along, I don't think he'd find his way back home. But it's kind of cute.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and theshelterpetproject.org.
I'm Greg Pritting.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. And Diane, let's see what's in the news.
There's actually a lot of stuff in the news. It seems that the election has overtaken even USADA. But there was one very encouraging item. The UCI suspended its case against Paul Kimmage and has agreed to investigate corruption in its own house. It's an article published by Velo News on October 26th. The UCI held out an olive branch in one of cycling's darkest moments Friday after giving its nod to Lance Armstrong's lifetime ban and stripping him of his 7 Tour de France wins on Monday. It made more moves today, agreeing to an independent commission to study allegations of corruption and suspending its lawsuit against journalist Paul Kimmage. The committee agreed that part of the independent commission's remit would be to find ways to ensure that persons caught for doping were no longer able to take part in the sport, including as part of an entourage. in an emergency meeting called in Geneva to address the fallout from the Lance Armstrong doping scandal, the management committee voted to install an independent commission to examine accusations of corruption at the UCI made in sworn testimony included in the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency's Armstrong case file. The committee also urged riders implicated in the Armstrong investigation to return prize money earned between 1998 and 2005. Kimmage will breathe a sigh of relief. It appears that after a day-long meeting in Geneva, the UCI's management committee came to grips with what it was facing. Not only were they battling Kimmage, who has a public defense fund that has surpassed 80,000, but many in cycling who have lost faith in the federation's management of the sport. So we'll see what happens. Jonathan Vaughters, you know, weighed in. So it was very interesting.
Did you see that the head of the International Olympic Committee, however, came out, very firmly said that cycling's place in the Olympics is not in danger. So I was kind of hoping that...
That they would sort of hold that as a bargaining chip
to make sure there's some reform in the UCI.
Yeah.
So, you know, it could be an opportunity for a lot of new blood because when you think about it, somebody's got to ride on those teams. Somebody's got to manage those teams.
Right.
And if all of these, ex-dopers get the boot... Cycling's going to be
sort of thin.
Well, and
we'll see.
There'll be opportunities.
Will be opportunities. Yeah. And, you know, I'm hoping some, you know, sponsors step up. So this came from our friend Steve Frothingham, you know, the online editor of Bicycle Retailer and Industry News, about the problems getting around in New York City post-Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. Manhattan Beach, New York, from Brain, the bike industry in New York and nationally is pitching in to help commuters use bikes in post-Sandy New York City this week. The industry and advocates are making the most of an opportunity to help people use their bikes in hopes that they will continue to do so when transportation in the city returns to normal. It's possible. Advocacy group Transportation Alternatives, and we talked to their president not too long ago, set up aid stations on three bridges in the city on last Thursday and is manning a station at Midtown on 6th Avenue, one of the busiest bike routes in the city. The stations offer maps, route advice and tips, mechanical assistance, floor pumps, and coffee. Paul Steely White told Brain. By all accounts, there are thousands of new bicyclists on the street today, White said. There is a lot of bicycle ownership in New York City. What we are seeing is people putting those bikes to work. And Manhattan employers are being encouraged to allow workers to bring their bikes into the building for parking this week. I think it's really, really cool.
Well, with most of the New York City subway system out of commission right now and a lot of the bus lines really
overtaxed. Yeah, you're waiting like hours for a bus.
Well,
right.
They had epic gridlock. They said a car commute from Queens to Manhattan was taking 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
Just because so many people who are normally using transit are now all of a sudden in cars.
Right.
So, yeah, when I heard that report, I'm thinking I would absolutely be on my bike.
Absolutely.
There's no way you would want to sit in a car for 2 or 3 hours just to go a few miles.
Well, it's interesting that people have bikes. They don't necessarily know how to get from point A to point B. So the map thing is probably a good thing.
That brings me – I've been wanting to pose this rhetorical question to our listeners for a while now. When you ride your bike, do you take the bike route or the direct route? And conversely, when you go somewhere in your car, do you take the car route or do you find yourself taking the route that you find on your bike? Just an interesting thing
interesting?
To ponder.
Because when I go places, I like to go different routes not to be bored all the time. So I would imagine, you know, and probably time has something to do with it. You know, so if you find yourself short of time, you're going to take your shortest route.
True.
But just,
it's kind of a mindset because I have, I have places I typically go from my house.
Right.
And there's usually like what I think of as the car route, which is usually more heavily trafficked but more direct.
Right.
And then there's the route I would take if I was on my bike, which kind of gets the same place but avoids a lot of the, you know, hassle streets. So
that's
anyway,
correct.
Just food for thought.
Well, I have two more quick things and then one more news item. So Mike Freiberger posted on the Outspoken Cyclists timeline, Greg Priddy. On the last show, You mentioned that a $14,000 bike doesn't need fenders because you don't ride it in the rain. I'll give you that, but you need fenders on any urban bike because Bike Snob NYC theory says that you don't know what that liquid is on the urban roadscape. And I'm like, ew.
That is true.
What is that supposed to mean?
Well, it could be anything sloshing around.
I guess.
On
and
the
then
pavement.
David Pellin, who evidently lives in Detroit. See, people do listen to the show. Heard our comments on cycling in Detroit and said he appreciated that you're speaking toward Detroit's reputation rather than based on experience. There was actually some exciting cycling going on in the city, including the Beat the Train ride, which is beatthetrain.com, the Detroit City Criterium, and the greatest cyclocross race in all of Michigan, the Mad Anthony Cyclocross held at historic Fort Wayne. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting ride. They're not actually trying to, you know, race against trains or beat trains at
right,
crossings.
Right.
But it's a very early Saturday morning ride, about 6:15, 6:30, and 30 to 35 miles at a moderate pace. And interesting, they say that we take in the sights of the Motor City from ground level like you've never seen them before. Due to the city's decreasing population, the streets of Detroit are often largely empty, making them the perfect venue for cyclists. And I'm sure early on a Sunday morning, that is
even
never
more so.
True.
Right.
Yeah. So apparently, if you know where to ride and when to ride, even in Detroit, you can find a good place to ride.
All right. My last item. Tweed production spikes because of bikes. Hey, don't make fun of tweed. This comes from our friend Carlton Reed of bikebiz.com. Harris Tweed Industry Forum said 2012 has been the, quote, best year for production in 15 years, partly due to tweed bike rides. The global success of the Tweed Run, a tweed-centric bike ride which started in London in 2009, is one of the reasons for the revival in fortunes for the cloth woven on the Western Isles. The Harris Tweed Industry Forum said 2012 has been the best year for production in almost 15 years. Total production is expected to hit more than 1 million meters of cloth by the end of the year. In the 60s, production ran to about 7 million meters of cloth, but it dropped to just 500,000 meters in 2009. Ian Angus McKenzie, chief executive of Harris Tweed Hebrides, said, quote, we are confident that we currently have the right balance in terms of number of weavers, weaver capacity, and market demand. We are looking to continue to grow the value and diversity of the international market for the cloth, and this incremental growth will be supported by existing weavers and new entrants due to natural turnover within the workforce. So there is a really beautiful picture of all these people, right? You know, it's Brooke saddles and tweed suits.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so the tweed ride.
Tweed is the new Lycra.
Yeah. Yeah, and it doesn't even show anything strange.
Huh.
I thought that was fun. That's the end of the news.
All righty. And not a moment too soon, because we have an in-studio guest here.
We do. Chris Alvarado, who I met at the Bike Summit this year, is a delegate from Ohio to the Bicycle Summit. And he is an urban planner and is a new fellow. So I'll let him tell you about it. Chris, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening. It's nice to see you again.
It's good to see you. It's been too long.
Yes, it has. We met at the summit. You were part of the Ohio Bike Delegation. Were you the head of the Ohio Bike Delegation?
Oh, God,
no. Oh, that was Jody.
No, that would have been Jody.
Yeah.
This was the first year that Bike Cleveland had representation there.
Right.
Because it was the first year of our existence.
So I actually invited you here. Last week on the show, we mentioned a news piece about the fellowship that were awarded for Strong Cities, Strong Communities. I want to talk about that, but I also want to get a little bit of background and tell our listeners who you are and how your background relates to cycling.
Okay. Well, I just recently came to serve on this fellowship that we'll talk about in a little bit, but for the previous 12 years, I served as a planner for the Cuyahoga County Planning Commission. So that's the county that encompasses the city of Cleveland. It's the largest county in Ohio.
Right.
And I worked on bike and pedestrian issues along with other sustainability-related matters for Cuyahoga County. And it was really through my involvement there that Bike Cleveland actually began. It was something that planners like myself who are interested in active transportation was something that we developed. We recognized that there was a need for this kind of an organization in Northeast Ohio.
Well, explain what Bike Cleveland is. I know there are plenty of cities who have these kinds of organizations, but just roughly, what is Bike Cleveland?
Well, Bike Cleveland is the advocacy organization for cyclists in Northeast Ohio. So we've got we include Cuyahoga County, which includes the city of Cleveland, as well as some of the adjacent counties. And I think what makes us a little bit different from other advocacy organizations is that we kind of come in from the perspective of placemaking. We see that cycling is actually an integral part of building livable communities, places that are resilient. And because it was started by planners like myself, or folks who do community development or who see the importance of cycling as an integral part of neighborhood development, it may be a little bit different from, say, advocacy organizations that started, anywhere from 10 to 20 to 30 years ago that were really more focused on building up the number of cyclists and really focusing on that as the primary goal.
It's interesting that Cleveland is doing things finally, and that in some ways they're innovative, they're different, they're new. I don't know how much you have traveled to see what other communities are doing. I always think we're behind the curve. Do you think that we are going to really make cycling important in Northeast Ohio as far as urban transportation goes?
I think so. I don't know if I think one of the benefits of Bike Cleveland starting as late in the game as it has is that we're able to come in at a point in which cities are recognizing the importance of walkability, bikeability, livability as a part of becoming competitive in the global environment. And it's very different from organizations that started off with a primarily advocacy bent and that started at a time in which cities may have been less amenable to dense development or connections to nature. And so I think we're coming in at the right time, and there may be even a possibility for Bike Cleveland to be at the forefront of how it is that cycling advocacy organizations function throughout the United States, North America, or even the world.
Wow, that would be really cool to be at the forefront of something with cycling. I really like that idea. Well, we do have our new velodrome, of course.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I haven't gone on there, but I did recently win passes to take laps. So Jacob Van Sickle, our director, and I are going to race one another. He's got about 10 years of youth on me, though.
Well, that, you know what? It doesn't matter. You ride a bike, you'll be fine. And as far as I can tell, Brett and the crew are doing a great job training people. So I think it's good. He was just on a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, that's splendid.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the fellowship and the program associated with it. What is Strong Cities, Strong Communities? Who put the fellowship together and what's its purpose?
Okay, so Strong Cities and Strong Communities is a initiative that came out of the Obama administration. President Obama actually started an office there at the White House that was focused on urban issues. Now, this is different from, say, the Department of Housing and Urban Development that really focus on, say, building neighborhoods or creating affordable housing for folks. This initiative actually comes out of both the White House Office for Urban Affairs as well as the Department of Housing and Urban Development. But it has kind of a different take to it. The idea was that the Obama administration saw a need to provide not just services to cities in urban areas, legacy cities such as Cleveland, Detroit, Fresno, New Orleans, and Memphis, but also saw a need to create kind of wraparound services, look at how it is that the different departments, the administration departments, can work together to address complicated issues. And so they picked seven cities in which to start these Strong Cities, Strong Communities programs. And the fellowship that I'm a part of is actually one leg of a four-legged chair in that regard.
I'm trying to put my mind around what you mean about how it's different from HUD and what it's meant to do, actually.
Okay, so maybe a good way of describing this is to actually talk about the four different legs of this,
Let's do that.
Chair. So one has to do with this SC2 fellowship program. And the idea is to basically build the bench strength of cities. How is it that we're able to have the federal government support cities in creating new positions and building up mid to early career professionals who may be thinking about building neighborhoods in a different way that, say, your career planners or your career community developers or career economic development professionals might take a look at these things?
Okay, that's one.
Okay, so another leg is the development of the community solutions teams. So there's 19 different departments that actually are working together on these different teams. And so here in Cleveland, for example, we have staff members from the EPA, Housing and Urban Development, Department of Labor, the Army Corps of Engineers. Folks
Wow.
that don't traditionally work with one another are actually focusing on complex issues and providing services to the city of Cleveland from their different perspectives. Two other legs of this stool include the Economic Planning Challenge, which is a way of doling out money to cities that come up with innovative solutions. These are X-Prize style competitions. So the Obama administration asked for cities to come up with projects, and this past month, three cities actually won $1 million grants.
Were we one of them?
We were not one of them. Actually, we're
okay.
not even eligible to be one of them
okay.
because since the city of Cleveland participated in the fellowship program,
okay.
they didn't allow the fellowship cities to be a part of that.
So what kind of an award – I mean what city actually won an award, and what was it for, this $1 million? Do you have an example of it?
Sure. So Greensboro, North Carolina
okay.
is actually using their money to develop a comprehensive plan to align all these different economic development issues that they have and actually come up with a unified strategy for building up Greensboro. The other two cities that are involved are Hartford, Connecticut, and Las Vegas. And all these cities, including the cities that won the fellowships,
right.
All have similar issues when it comes to neighborhood development and economic development, but they have different types of problems that they're dealing with. Las Vegas is a boom town that has recently come on hard times because of the foreclosure crisis. They have acres upon square miles of vacant houses, whereas here in the city of Cleveland, we don't have that kind of problem, but we do have a vacant property problem that needs to be dealt with.
So is there any component of what you're doing and what some of the other people are doing about the sort of the exodus of people from the city? And I'm going to get back to where transportation is kind of part of that.
Absolutely. So my work here at the city of Cleveland has to do with improving the land bank process. Right now, the city of Cleveland owns 11,000 parcels, vacant parcels.
Really?
And more are coming in by the week. And it's up to us to figure out how is it that we can get those parcels to best use, be they community gardens or helping folks expand their side yards or preferably increasing both residential and commercial development.
I see. And are there incentives for people to actually get these, to come into the city?
Well, they come very cheaply. So
okay,
let's say, for example,
they're cheap.
If you wanted to build a house,
right.
Say in one of our neighborhoods, you would be able to get a property for around $100.
Oh, my goodness.
And these are properties that are in walkable, livable neighborhoods because the city sees it as an important part of its competitive strategy to build neighborhoods that cater to folks who don't want to drive around.
So all the cities that are involved in this Strong City, Strong Communities program have the same kinds of issues going on, I take it, or similar at least.
They have similar issues, and they're going about it different ways. So we have three fellows who are embedded at the city of Cleveland here.
Okay.
I work with land bank issues. Another one of our fellows, Tim Kobe, he works on demolition issues with building and housing. So how is it that we target land to be cleared so that we can redevelop it again? And then Jenna Petralla is working on economic development marketing issues. How is it that we market property in the city of Cleveland to either existing businesses that would like to expand what it is that they do or attract new businesses? Now, in different other cities, the fellows may be working on public health issues or they could also be working on workforce development issues. It really just depends on the unique circumstances of each one of these seven cities.
So let's wrap transportation into it and how it impacts not only all these cities, but these particular issues that each of the cities is working on.
Well, transportation and land use are there are two issues that are absolutely linked to one another. Without smart land use, having neighborhoods that are densely developed where you can, say, choose public transportation or where one could walk to a corner store, it's something that requires a concerted effort when it comes to densifying neighborhoods and also creating green space so that folks who live in those neighborhoods would be able to get to, say, trails or be able to access the kind of open space amenities that folks traditionally associate with suburban development.
So how do you get people who have sort of fled the city to live in suburban areas or even rural areas to come back to the city? What is it that is going to compel people? And I think it'll be the next generation of people. Certainly, you know, I'm seeing a gap. You're not going to probably get 40-year-olds with growing kids coming back into the city if they've moved out 10, 15 miles.
Well, it very much depends. So, like you said, there is this gap. We've got the millennials who are coming up who are less interested in an automobile lifestyle, who want to be out with their friends, who want to be able to bike around, who enjoy being able to walk around the corner to go to a restaurant or a bar or to see a movie. And then you've also got folks who are reaching a retirement age or who have already retired, who, again, may not feel either comfortable driving around or who've done that all of their lives and who just want to get rid of that and be able to have a small town type of existence, but to do that within a city. And so those are folks that are easy to reach. But I think there's kind of a myth when it comes to folks who live in the suburbs, and that is that we believe that these folks chose to have a suburban lifestyle. When in reality, it may just be that it was the cheapest option that was available. We've had so many different incentives that make it easier for somebody to buy a house, 2,000 to 4,000 square foot house on a half acre to 1 acre piece of property. And these incentives range from homeowner incentives through HUD,
right,
ironically enough, to the incentives that we've put in place through the Department of Transportation for highways that make it cheaper to drive out to these suburbs, when in reality, you know, maybe some of these folks would have preferred to live in a neighborhood that was within a 3-mile bike ride of their workplace or some place where they could actually know their neighbors versus driving into their garage at the end of the day and not seeing anybody.
So I have two other things I want to talk about. For one second, let me just remind our listeners, we're speaking with Chris Alvarado. He is with the Bike Cleveland. He's the president of the board of Bike Cleveland.
That's correct.
And he is also a fellow from the Strong City, Strong Communities program that comes out of the Obama administration. So do you know about the new BOEM Strategy Center? So this is sort of a little different take, something that's happening just in our industry, in the bicycle industry, that was announced this week.
I've heard a little bit about it. So.
Okay. So I know that you and I are members of the Ohio delegation. We go to the Bike Summit. That is our lobbying sort of organization, the League of American Bicyclists. My understanding of the BOEM Strategy Center, and Leslie BOEM was a very popular and famous guy who was very heavily into making sure that cycling stayed in the forefront of people's thinking, especially when it comes to government. So they've hired a young woman named Jen Dice, who is a staffer at IMBA, who evidently is just a firecracker. And they are actually putting her into a position of power to begin to track how it's sort of like we'll have our own lobbying organization, but strictly looking at legislation, legislators, you know, those kinds of things, very focused on making sure that if somebody you know, goes left or goes right, that we know what's happening for bicycling. What do you think about that?
I think it's critical. The fact that, you know, legislators only say hear about cycling issues once per year.
Right.
I mean, it's important. That's, you know, that those couple of days that we spend on Capitol Hill knocking on our representatives' doors and telling them about the importance of cycling to their communities, that's something that needs to continue. But having a 365-day-a-year presence to keep that issue at the forefront is absolutely essential. And I think it may also provide an opportunity for us to do some coalition building outside of, say, your traditional cycling constituencies, be they the bike shops or the cyclists or urban planners like myself who see the importance of active transportation. I think having somebody there with the Boehm Center gives us an opportunity to expand that tent so that it's not just cyclists on our own, maybe working with folks who are dealing with pedestrian issues, but that there's an opportunity for us to tie into, say, the healthcare community. Or even tie into the development community. One of the things that is a myth about the development community is that they're really just interested in suburban-style development, when in reality there is a lot of complexity to that particular constituency. And so being able to reach out to developers who know how to work in urban areas is absolutely going to be critical, especially since they have the dollars to really be able to leverage change.
It's interesting you say that and that you brought up the healthcare industry, because Rails to Trails just announced a coalition kind of thing between Rails to Trails and the healthcare industry. So I see all of it broadening. Well, this has been really enlightening. It's really good to be able to talk to you and catch up and talk to you about your work, because, you know, when we were in Washington, it was all about that work. So, and I knew you were an urban planner and that you've been doing it a long time. I wish you a lot of luck with this fellowship. I'd like to follow up as we get closer to the end of it and find out how it went.
That'll be a lot of fun. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for coming into the studio.
My pleasure.
All right, Chris. Good night.
Chris Alvarado joined us right here in the WJCU studios.
Yes, he did.
He's doing some very interesting work.
He is.
Very exciting.
It is exciting, and his passion for it is even more exciting. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy that he's got such a depth of understanding of all of this.
I hope that there is kind of a land rush of people coming back into the city and picking up those empty lots for $100 and building on them. That would be super.
It would be super. Who knows what kind of mortgages people can get. You know, that's going to be an issue. But maybe they'll get helped by the city, and you have HUD. You have all kinds of things going on. But we'll have to see. We'll just have to see.
Well, money is cheap right now.
If
you have a credit rating... and some money.
That isn't bad.
If you have a credit rating, you can get some cheap money. Look at the people who don't have an existing mortgage.
Yes.
And a property that they have to sell first.
Right.
This is perfect. New graduates with a job. And
it's the question of whether you want to live in the city. And I think that's a question that is still unanswered for a lot of people. For me, I would love it.
Going to come a day when we might not have a choice to live in the suburbs.
That would be nice. I like the city.
Okay, we've
used our time up.
Rambled enough here.
Yes, we have.
We will be back next week. We hope your power is back next week.
I hope
week.
Your power is back.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll all sort itself out, and this will just be a bad memory here in a few days. And so we'll see you then. Ride safely and be safe and stay warm.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.